After Deadline, normally heard at this time, is taking a holiday break. This morning we bring you a special program with Dr. Stephen Burke, a local columnist and retired professor of history at Clatsop Community College. He was the keynote speaker at the college's roundtable forum on the Occupy Wall Street movement held last month. This half hour, we'll hear his presentation on the development of neoliberalism in America. Now let's join Dr. Burke as he begins his presentation.
We find ourselves today in the second era of what could be called robber baron capitalism. That's what it was called when we referred to it with regard to the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, the era of the great fortunes, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the J.P. Morgan, and so on. Those guys actually, on the positive side, built America. They did provide industry and jobs in America, even though those workers were badly underpaid, and they provided the infrastructure of America. They did that under classical liberalism, which I'll talk about in a minute. The neoliberal idea actually takes our jobs and outsources them to low-wage countries with no environmental regulations, or very little environmental regulations, in order to ruthlessly cut costs. And engineered by these giant transnational corporations, which now dwarf the size of even the regular governments of the various nation states of the world. These free trade deals trump the laws of the nation states. One of the things that people get confused about, the word liberalism itself is a very slippery word. If you listen to the talk show ranters, liberalism is this nasty redistributed thing that takes all the money from the good guys who make it and gives it to the lazy poor people who don't want to work. And believe me, there's lots of Americans who believe that today because a number of years ago in the Reagan administration, the fairness doctrine was taken away and people with a big bad axe to grind and a particular point of view usually funded by giant corporate interests were able to take over large segments of public media and fill the public full of nonsense about liberalism. The liberalism I grew up under, welfare state liberalism, I'll talk about that initially. What that did, and it arose in three reform movements in the 20th century, the progressive era, 1900 to 1917, the New Deal era, which is also the era of the Great Depression, 1933 until World War II, and what people of my generation call the era of the Great Society, which was the continuation of the New Deal during the Johnson administration. The welfare state liberalism, what it basically did was it passed progressive taxation on income and on corporations that redistributed wealth downward. It did not eliminate the wealth of the upper classes. There was still plenty of rich people in America who lived plenty well. But it redistributed wealth downward. As a result, education, when I went to school, was very low priced. But this was because wealth was distributed downward. We had a tax structure where the top tax rate was actually 90%. And businessmen and corporations, in order to avoid high taxes, had to plow the money back into their own corporation. And the corporations grew, and they produced jobs. And wages were up, so demand was high, and that fueled the consumer-driven capitalism that gave us prosperity. Well, what's happened since then? The development of neoliberalism. In order to understand what neoliberalism is, we need to go back to classical liberalism. The original meaning of the term liberalism is the liberalizing of trade. When the United States became the United States, it separated from Great Britain. Great Britain held it as a series of 13 colonies in a system known as mercantilism. Mercantilism has an aristocratic upper class that plants colonies abroad. Many of the countries of Western Europe did this. Mercantilism set up colonies abroad in the New World extracted resources from the New World. Imperialism always is for the purpose of extracting resources from colonized countries. American merchants and planters revolted because they wanted to be able to trade freely. All their trade had to go through Britain. The reason is that in mercantilism, the whole idea was to provide a favorable balance of trade, not for the colonies, but for the mother country. The colonies were not allowed to manufacture. The mother country did all the manufacturing. The raw materials were shipped from the colonies to the mother country. And then the mother country manufactured goods and sent it back. And this fueled the development of the English Industrial Revolution. The English were the first ones to develop the Industrial Revolution. And it also fueled American discontent because we were not allowed to manufacture our own goods. Kind of come full circle, haven't we? We don't manufacture our own goods anymore. We provide raw materials for other countries, except it happens to be China today, and we get the finished goods from China. Very interesting. We've kind of come full circle. We've become, in effect, in a sense, a kind of colony of China. Classical liberalism, some of you might have heard of Adam Smith. Adam Smith wrote a book called Wealth of Nations. And it actually came out in 1776. I used to say it was the commercial class's Declaration of Independence that paralleled the political Declaration of Independence that was written by Thomas Jefferson. It was in the planter class, but he was tied into the commercial classes. Classical liberalism basically is in a system of pure competition where corporations are only entities that are temporary. A corporation was traditionally formed very briefly to do a particular project. It was chartered by a state or government entity, and then it went out of existence. In the 19th century, or in a state where corporations are that limited, then you have something closer to pure competition. And Adam Smith had that famous comment, statement that an invisible hand of the market creates a kind of rough-hewn equality by eliminating those who can't compete in the market and those who can compete thrive. But a kind of prosperity is shared by all. This was a middle-class fond hope. It doesn't necessarily work out in practice, even in a state of pure competition. But the fact is you rarely have a state of pure competition. It's a figment of the imagination of classical economists that you ever get a state of pure competition. What happened, though, is you get the development of corporations in the 19th century, the limited liability corporation. This is the publicly traded corporation. The corporations that developed the colonies in America were joint stock corporations. And if you were part of the London Company that settled Virginia or the Plymouth Company that settled in what became Massachusetts Bay, those companies, every one of the partners was liable for the debts of the company. So if the company went under, the whole kit and caboodle, all of the people who were invested in it were responsible for that, and they could be sued and all kinds of nasty things could happen. So what developed in the 19th century was the publicly traded corporation based on limited liability. You're only liable for the amount that you invest. So if I invest stock in General Motors, General Motors goes under, it's only my stock that I lose. I'm not responsible for General Motors' debts. Basically, what you have is the development of a form of capitalism that we call corporate capitalism. The corporation becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Aggregates of capital become bigger and bigger and bigger. There is a element in the free market in which the larger tends to swallow the smaller. Charles Darwin was becoming well-known and popularized in the 19th century. Darwin liked to emphasize that nature was based on a struggle for existence and survival of the fittest. As a guy named Karl Marx said, the struggle for existence and survival of the fittest described market conditions in a developing capitalist economy, and so it caught on. And it became a way of looking at life. People tend to look at life out of the what Marx liked to call the relations of production, where you have, and he used to think that the motive force of history was class conflict, that you have an owning class, which was commonly called a bourgeois class in the 19th century, or commercial class or industrial class that owns the means of production, and they create a working class that works there, but they don't own the tools of their trade. They don't own the means of production, so they're separated from them. Classical liberalism basically says that the government pretty much stays out of the economic sphere and allows it to develop on its own. Okay? You have relatively small government. You know, the government never completely stayed out, though. The government did a lot of things for corporations. They didn't do much for the average person. They did in the 19th century declare labor unions conspiracies and restraint of trade. They did not, however, ever say that giant aggregates of capital, at least they didn't say this in the 19th century, which became these big corporations known as trusts, were conspiracies and restraint of trade. In the 20th century, the progressive era, you begin to get that when Teddy Roosevelt, who was certainly no socialist by a long shot, Teddy Roosevelt talked about the malefactors of wealth. And then his cousin Franklin in the 30s talked about a term which Paul Krugman brought back in an article that was reprinted in the Daily Historian the other day, and I like the term, economic royalists. Can you name the economic royalists in Congress today? I can name a lot of them. Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, there's a couple of them. And Mr. Walker in Wisconsin is another. All right. In classical liberalism, the state is not supposed to intervene in the economy. But as I say, the state did intervene, largely on behalf of corporations. They granted large tracts of land to railroads. Why? So that the railroads would have incentive to move across the continent. The Homestead Act in 1860 granted 160 acres to anybody who could get out there. It took a year's worth of provisions, at least. Didn't have any freeways to get there in those days. And the fact is, wherever you got the 160 acres, if there was not a railroad spur built to your area, you couldn't market your goods. So maybe you could do subsistence farming if the weather was good, and you could get the seed and all the other things you needed for subsistence farming. But most American farmers wanted to do commercial farming. They wanted to a cash crop that they could sell on the market. So they had to purchase land from the railroads. So here was the government intervening on behalf of this big interest, the railroads. And the railroads were the first big corporate interest in America. And we can think of the Vanderbilt family, for example, that owned the New York Central as one of these railroads. We can think of the Harrimans and the James J. Hills and the Great Northern, Collis B. Huntington, the Southern Pacific, so on. It's interesting to note, by the way, that the first case in which corporate personhood was granted, something that has really become problematic today with Citizens United, the first case, it was called Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County, 1886, during the old Gilded Age. In that case, the court supposedly said, actually, as I understand it, they never quite actually said it, but it was interpreted to have been said that way. And actually, clerks of the Supreme Court, rather than the judges themselves, had a lot of influence here. It was an odd case. But they basically said that, the 14th Amendment, which is the Equal Protection Amendment that came out of the Civil War, that was created to give African Americans who had been slaves the rights of citizens, those rights were now taken and given to corporations as citizens. There was another important corporate personhood amendment, not quite a century later, Buckley versus Vallejo, where Senator James Buckley of New York, after the reforms following the Watergate affair in 1974, where money was abused in a political campaign for the Nixon presidency, there were reforms that went through Congress limiting the amount of money that one wealthy person could put into a campaign and limiting money in other ways. James Buckley, brother of William F. Buckley, the father of modern American conservatism, was a senator from New York. He wanted to put a lot of the family's money into his campaign. He wasn't allowed to do so as a result of the laws in the wake of Watergate and a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, really important case. The Supreme Court in 1976, actually a more liberal court in the welfare state liberalism context of that term, not classically liberal, but welfare state liberal. That court, which is more liberal than today's court, headed by Warren Berger, who had been appointed by Nixon, said that money in political campaigns equals free speech. That began a long ride to the purchase of our political campaigns by great aggregates of capital, much as they had owned our legislators in the late 19th century. Some of you might remember the cartoons by Thomas Nast. I sometimes think where the word nasty came from, those cartoons. Thomas Nast had these big money bags, which looked like big fat men, but they were shaped as money bags with heads and little feet. And it said beef trust, sugar trust, steel trust, you know, money trust, J.P. Morgan, so on. And they had them sitting in the Senate, in the various Senate chairs. Well, Citizens United in 2010 puts the final finishing blow on representative government in the United States, as far as I'm concerned. In Citizens United versus the U.S. Electoral Commission, a modest set of reforms authored by a Republican, by John McCain, and Feingold of Wisconsin, Democrat and Republican, very modest reforms, were pretty much thrown out by the court. And the court not only said that any corporation can put money into campaigns, but any entity whatsoever, it could do so secretly. So China could control our political campaigns if they wanted to, but we'd never know. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? What does that do to representative democracy? What is neoliberalism? If you go back to... How much time we got?
Keep going.
Such a huge subject. There was a conference at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in 1944 that involved the big three, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. I think Stalin was involved in it, although he didn't ultimately participate in the system that was created thereby. It involved all the countries, many of the countries that were on the Allied side in the Second World War. And it was to set up an order for after the war. It was influenced by Keynes, but it created two interesting institutions which have had a profound effect on the world economy. The World Bank and something called the International Monetary Fund. Okay. Now, this was originally, it had to do with, the idea was the trade liberalization. And what they mean by trade liberalization is the taking down of tariff barriers. Tariffs were originally created, you can go back to Alexander Hamilton's report on manufacturers for this. Tariffs were originally created for the purpose of protecting infant industries from foreign competition as they grew. But in the free trade regimen, it's hard to do that. Every country that actually develops and grows and becomes fully industrialized has to protect its own industries from foreign competition. If it can't do that, it can never grow into an industrialized
nation state. Keep that in mind. So tariffs do good things. A lot of very high tariffs prevent any trade from happening, and they can, you know, too much of something is always bad. All things in moderation, the Aristotelian golden mean, that type of thing is a good thing. But the free traders basically had the idea that if you lower tariff barriers, trade will result all over the world and the whole world will become prosperous. But what has ultimately happened is not quite that. That was under the Keynesian system, where the development of what are called the lesser developed countries, or sometimes called the third world countries, in the wake of the demonstrations against the WTO in the late 90s, they became known as the Global South, because most of these countries are to the south. And they are, incidentally, the ones that are being most devastated by global warming, climate change, etc. These countries, there was a redistributive mechanism where a strong public sector was allowed to continue to exist in these countries. Taxes were supposed to be progressive and redistributed downward for relief of the poor. And development was supposed to occur from the bottom up. For example, in Latin America, campesinos, people who work on small farms or as field workers, would be supported by this kind of system. What's happened, however, once you get these huge transnational corporations, such as International Agribusiness, a new order has developed. You had a series of trade conferences culminating in what was called the Uruguay Round of the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which started actually as far back as the creation of the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF and the World Bank were supposed to fund international development. And ideally, they do. But in fact, it hasn't worked out that way. It hasn't worked out necessarily for the benefit of the masses of people around the world. And these are some of the reasons that I'll give you. The IMF, for example, in recent years, particularly since the 70s, has gotten involved. They would lend large amounts of money to third world countries for development of hydroelectric dams and electricity, let's say. That's one thing. These huge, massive projects of industrial development. They would lend money to these countries to do that. They would lend money that these countries ultimately could not pay back. So these countries got in debt to the IMF. And they got so deeply in debt that they could not pay the money back. The IMF and the World Bank have been dominated by the United States. And so what happens is transnational corporations, many of them based in the United States, such as the big oil corporations, extract their pound of flesh. And their pound of flesh being oil drilling rights. For example, in Ecuador, you have oil drilling rights on lands of native peoples. These native peoples have sacred burial grounds. These are their lands. But oil was discovered there, and so the oil drilling rights preempted the rights of these native peoples. Agribusiness, under the NAFTA Act, North American Free Trade Agreement, which was negotiated under the Clinton administration. This is a part of liberalization in the wake of the Uruguay Round, which took place in the early 90s, which created the WTO, the World Trade Organization. NAFTA basically said that big agribusiness companies, such as Cargill, Monsanto, other companies could dump large amounts of corn in Mexico and undersell the corn being produced by small local Mexican farmers. It threw the people off the land, off of their land. They ended up in hovels on the edge of cities with nothing, or they end up wanting to migrate to the United States. These are some of the effects of neoliberalism. What's happened in the neoliberal order is that transnational corporations through the World Trade Organization have gotten more and more power to the point that they dwarf the power of the nation states themselves to protect their own people. Latin Americans have recently gotten wise to this, and they have begun to resist these loans and become somewhat more independent. And for example, in Venezuela, they're redistributing oil wealth to the poor and resisting these loans. One brief word about Naomi Klein and the shock doctrine and the rise of disaster capitalism, which I think is the single most important book that you can read. And Klein is a journalist, not an economist, and she writes lucidly, brilliant writer. What she talks about is that these giant corporations and the neoliberal world order use disasters such as huge economic meltdowns, such as we've been experiencing since 2008, or the big tsunami that wiped out so many beaches from Sri Lanka to Indonesia to Malaysia, or Hurricane Katrina. They use disasters to come in and privatize. They underfund the public agencies like FEMA in Hurricane Katrina, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, that is supposed to deal with the problem and would have restored, given enough money, the lower Ninth Ward, which is the ward of New Orleans that got hit hardest, where the poorest people live. But in fact, what happens is in disaster capitalism, the corporation, the transnational corporation, comes in and takes advantage of the disaster by privatizing public services and by building, and this has happened in the wake of the great tsunami in the Far East, building high-rise condos for the wealthy and knocking out local, small, fishing-based economies of people who lived on the beaches. It's a huge subject. I haven't got... I'm out of time.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special presentation with Dr. Stephen Burke, a local columnist and retired professor of history at Clatsop Community College. He was the keynote speaker at the college's roundtable forum on the Occupy Wall Street movement held last month. If you missed any part of this program, you can listen to or download a copy from our website, coastradio.org. This has been a production of Coast Community Radio.